bill that requires
How are you?
Common sense.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness to order for Thursday, April 2nd, as it turns out. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3386. Mr. Administrator, do you want to tell us what that bill is about? And then,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3386 was carried over from 331. Establishes the Oregon Public Utility Homeland Security Commission, directs the Office of Emergency Management to issue grants for the purposes of funding private utility disaster mitigation projects, and authorizes issuance of lottery bonds as specified. There may be a fiscal and revenue impact. Statements have not yet been issued, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay. Representative Evans, it's
a please. Bill.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, and for the record, I'm still Paul Evans, represent House District 20, West Salem, South Salem, Monmouth, Independence. I'm going to try to keep my comments today relatively short. We have a couple of folks that want to come in and speak on this particular bill, but I'd like to outline the approach. The bottom line is that when it comes to resiliency and it comes to planning for catastrophic events, be they human-caused or natural-made, the ability, especially in our increasingly technological world, the ability to maintain certainty and power and utilities is even more critical. The goal of this bill is very simply to establish a Homeland Security Commission that's focused specifically on public utilities. It would have connection with and involvement from, I hope, private industry, but it is really focused mostly on the public's, with the idea to do two or three things. Number one, to be able to encourage the kind of successful collaboration that has occurred in Portland and Eugene, some of the metro areas among the energy groups. The second is, in terms of taking that statewide for a statewide value, the second is to have a group of people that can come back in the next session with a set of priorities for potential strategic investments, especially for protecting the public utility grids. And the third is to help prioritize where we might be able to make long-term strategic investments in certain public spaces, perhaps including some state parks, some county fairgrounds, and some other areas that have adequate spacing, potential good geography for where future response recovery operations might take place, and building up the energy infrastructure in those facilities. But having a plan before we just start trying to throw money. So that's the overall part of the bill. This doesn't necessarily need to happen this year, but it is hopefully something that we can continue to work on, bringing people together, coming up with a strategic way for investing, because at the end of the day, as Representative Vice Chair Boone has said, we have a huge problem waiting, and I hope we can at least take care of some of the threats, even in by inches, if we have to win it by inches. And this is one of those measures. So I'll stop there and try to respond to any questions you might have.
Anybody have any questions?
Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thank you, Representative Evans, for doing this. It's needed. You got my support.
Oh. Thank you, Vice Chair. Oh, out of the way.
Sure. Sean McCormick, do you want to step forward?
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor with the Oregon Military Department. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I will mirror the good representative and try to keep my comments short and sweet. The Military Department is neutral on House Bill 3386, but should the legislation move forward and the commission and the fund be established, we will do everything in our power to create a relevant, realistic, and useful grant program to implement all the requirements that are outlined in the bill. The committee does need to know that the legislation does come at a cost to OEM. OEM has estimated that they're going to need two permanent full-time FTE, one program-related staff and one fiscal-related staff, to implement policies, procedures, accounting structures, and whatnot. That structure is consistent across all the grants that OEM manages, so EMPG, Homeland Security, Public Assistance, et cetera. We've estimated the cost at approximately $307,000 for a biennium. It would come as other funds. It would be financed through the sale of the lottery bonds, as outlined, I believe in Section 4 of the legislation. So that's just a real brief summary of the financial impacts of the bill. A couple of key points with regards to critical infrastructure and key resources. We just want to let the committee know that there are nationally there are 16 critical infrastructure sectors, with a portion of them being identified as lifeline sectors. Those are transportation systems, energy, communication, water, and emergency services. So those are the sectors that are really critical that they be prepared in advance of a disaster, and also one of the first ones to get fixed post-disaster. Currently in the state, the Titan Fusion Center at the Department of Justice is developing and implementing the state's critical infrastructure and key resource program. To my understanding, they have hired staff. They're developing, they developed a working group, and they are establishing the state plan as we speak. At OEM, we're engaged through our public-private partnership program, trying to strengthen relationships, helping to build strategic plans and capacities across all spectrums of the critical infrastructure sectors. So, in conclusion, the military department is neutral on 3386, but should the legislation move forward, we're committed to creating and implementing a useful grant program. And we do want to say that we are pleased to see that a conversation surrounding state investment in preparedness of critical infrastructure, just like consumer-owned utilities, is going on. We think it's a great conversation to be having, and we'll be happy to be engaged in as much as possible.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Anybody have any questions for Mr. Corey? Okay. Right. Thanks a lot
Thank you.
Coming. So I'm going to call up three witnesses, Craig Campbell, Ted Case, and Jeff Julem. Are you in, Mr. Campbell, are you in the right committee here? Just checking. We don't often see you, I assume.
Yeah. You heard it was a good committee.
That's right.
I don't care who starts first.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Lively, rest of the committee, my name is Jeff Julem. You've seen me before. Here I'm wearing a different hat. For 29 years, I served in the Army as an intelligence officer, so I've spent my whole life studying the threat to America, and I'm here to talk about why 3386 is such a good bill and needed. I currently also am working with Storm King Analytics, which is a government-funded firm studying the latest iterations of threat, and I'm here to testify on that very briefly. So the project that we're working on right now is looking at the new form of terrorism. We're used to looking at terrorism as these large groups of people out in the desert doing things, and we can track them on satellite, and we can kind of keep an eye on them. What we're discovering under a concept called ungoverned spaces is that terrorism is beginning to develop in ways we don't see coming. You're saying, how is that possible? When they can hide in places like favelas or slums in big third world cities, you might not see them at all. And using the internet to communicate, we might not know they're there. And they have the ability with modern global infrastructure to hit before we're ready. A good example happened this morning, if you've heard the news, that El Shabaab hit in eastern Kenya today. They're able to move rapidly and hit rapidly. Boko Haram in Nigeria is another one. And so these groups oftentimes appear to be like local menaces, but they can be international menaces before we even realize it. So what? The so what is they're good about targeting those critical resources and infrastructures when they hit. They understand that. I've looked at some of their websites. They understand how technologically dependent we are. And should they choose to attack in this sector of the country, they would know what to go after, those critical lifelines that were briefed earlier. So it's important that we do have as much resiliency as possible to deal with this impending threat. And DOD estimates that at least one or two attacks from this will happen in the next decade. So it's something we need to be aware of and be ready for. Subject to any questions, I've concluded my part of the testimony.
Any questions? Should we feel more comfortable after you testified or not? I'm just checking.
We're doing good so far.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, serving 200,000 members in the most rural and remote parts of the state. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of this legislation. I think it's a very important bill. We take our disaster planning and mitigation responsibilities very seriously, like I think every utility in the state. We've got business continuity plans and mutual aid agreements and all these type of things in place to get the power back on as quickly as I can, as we can. But the natural disaster component of this bill, I think, is really important to us because I think, as Vice Chair Boone knows, we represent the remote parts of the state that just seem to attract these type of biblical events. I think West Oregon Electric Cooperative, that Representative Boone knows very well, has FEMA on speed dial because every sort of flood or high wind event seems to come that way. And in fact, they had to move their office a couple years ago because it got flooded out. They had to relocate. So we understand about disasters and what it costs for that. What we're focused on right now, particularly along the coast, is the Cascadia event. We've got a Coos Creek Electric Co-op that's got a big swath of the South Coast, and everything that they seem to do is focused on preparing for the unthinkable, and that's the Cascadia event. They've got people on those task forces. And I just want to make a couple points about some of the things they're doing, because I think it makes a point about, I think, what Representative Evans is trying to do with these funding. They have built a centralized dispatch center at one of their offices with backup emergency generation. They've converted three hilltop communication sites from overhead to underground, and they've inventoried all 14 of their substations that need to be strengthened in case of an earthquake. The point in all of this is those activities all cost money. And sometimes this is money that we haven't budgeted for. We are planning for an event that may not take place in our lifetimes. But it's still important to do. So I think what Representative Evans is trying to do, and we so appreciate it, start the conversation about the things we need to do, that these are going to be very costly endeavors. And if the unthinkable is going to happen, something that's going to shake the ground for 6 minutes and cost, you know, millions of dollars and you know, cause unthinkable casualties, we've got to be prepared and we've got to have the resources to do it. So commend the representative for that. Start the conversation, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say the thanks for you guys being here, too, and for doing this and calling for the bigger picture look. But, you know, it never hurts to be prepared. I wasn't a Boy Scout, but I know they do that. But I did want to ask one question, and maybe, although your cover's blown, because you do look like a spy. Jeff, is there an element of the cybersecurity stuff that we're seeing a lot of? There's actually a whole center for it now up in Seattle, and that Penware is part of. And but there's a lot of activity along those lines, because it's those systems that run the utilities and everything else. And I just wondered if that's part of this, or would be. Maybe that's...
Cyber is definitely a part of this. I'm not going to bore you with all the lists of cyber attacks that have happened in the last decade or so, but I know that... I knew that the last... 7-8 years ago, an IT manager with the Oregon Military Department went to a conference in Portland, and they were very concerned. It's a decade ago. They were extremely concerned with the Chinese hitting of the infrastructure on the West Coast through a cyber attack. The Chinese are very capable. They're very good. When I was serving at West Point, they took out West Point for a day. I don't know how they did that. We don't know how they did that, but through a DoD portal. So they're skilled and adept, and they've got people always on hand to do this. Now, I'm not saying that China's going to attack us, per se. What I am saying is, if it takes a disgruntled person, and say, in Jakarta, Indonesia, that we know nothing about, like I mentioned earlier, who knows how to hack, then we have problems. We don't see that one coming. And the cyber is one of the most vulnerable points to our power grid, to our infrastructure. And frankly, if you've ever seen like a power shortage or something, it's like we can't function anymore, right? It's like we just don't know how to function without all the power functions and everything else and the internet that goes with it. And we have too many systems that are based upon that. So, yes, you're absolutely correct. Very vulnerable.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, always welcome in our committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative in support of the bill, and thank you very much for the warm welcome. This is not the committee that I'm used to seeing many of you in front of. There once was a time when I was in front of this committee far more often, and what I'm here to talk about is more in general along the lines of what Mr. Case had presented. Umatilla Electric Cooperative is, from the Cascadia standpoint, in a much more secure place because we're in the far northeast portion of the state. Nevertheless, as a cooperative, when we're dealing with infrastructure costs, those costs are always borne by our members. And so as much as we try to be on top of making sure that we have systems that have these sorts of protections in place, anytime you're able to provide additional funds that allow us to make sure that our critical infrastructure is resilient, redundant, and scalable, that's always going to be very helpful. I've always wanted to come in front of a committee and be able to say resilient, redundant, and scalable.
I'm sure you did.
but whenever you're dealing with critical infrastructure, the ability for it to withstand whatever the initial problem is, whether it be a terrorist attack or a natural disaster, if it can withstand that first hit, you're in a much better position. If that fails, then your ability to have a backup system in place allows you time to repair the initial system before that redundancy fails. And then the scalability is important because if you can isolate the damage so that it doesn't affect the entire system, then you're able to address your efforts on that portion of the system rather than trying to address the system as a whole. So thank you very much, Representative Evans, for that as an option. We hope that's what ends up happening. I know that I'm going to get an insightful question.
I saw him. I just thought, sorry.
Representative Huffman. Mr. Chair, I want to point out that Craig said exactly the same thing about rest areas. Resilient, redundant, and scalable. And it does apply.
It does fit. Yeah.
But I did have a serious question for the carrier if he would allow. That's good. I was reading the bill, and I don't see on which line it says that a work group would be established. And I'm just wondering which section that is.
Certainly, Representative Evans.
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, we do have an amendment.
We could put it in.
We could put it in, but after your last comment, I figured I'd hold off on that for a while. But yes, sir, we could do that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, on the comment about the rest areas, they are also excellent staging area potentials in the event of a natural disaster.
Nice.
Yeah. I'll keep you aside. There are some that we actually have talked about being potential areas.
No, I'm sure that's true. Mr. Case, I have a question. So, and I appreciate from a standpoint of the cost, you know, everything has a cost to it. But putting aside the cost, I'd like to understand a little bit more. So what can we be doing in the interim to the infrastructure? And I'm thinking about so many of the overhead power lines and that. So are there things we can be doing to those in between now and wherever that is that will help them better withstand the shaking versus where they are today?
Yeah, Chair Lively, members of the committee, thanks for the question. For us, it's really about hardening the critical infrastructure, whether it's control towers or transformers. Undergrounding is very expensive.
I know.
And very tough to do, and particularly in the areas that we serve. So as I noted in my testimony, Coos Kerry Electric Co-op has done that in some areas that they thought were really, really critical to do that. But I think, for us in Bonneville, Power Administration is a huge component for that's where we get our power. That's who's we have a lot of distribution line. They have a lot of the transmission line. So we're working closely with them. So I think more than anything, you know, cost is and funds is one thing, but putting the attention on this is from the legislature, sure. I think. What you're doing with this bill, I think, is the important part of it, just knowing that this is a long-term project. So I hope that's answer your question.
Because I knew the cost of undergrounding. We've had those debates in the city about just, and that's more driven just from the looks of the overhead versus under, but what the cost is. But I know from a resilience standpoint in that it has a better chance of surviving underground than it does hanging up.
It certainly does.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3386?
Thank you.
Okay. Not going to close the hearing on House Bill 3386. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2919. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2919 removes the reporting requirement of cellular device location used to call 911 in an emergency. There is no revenue impact, and there may be a fiscal impact statement not issued, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay. So I'm going to call on Leslie Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Lively, Vice Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Leslie Taylor. I'm the communications manager at the Lake Oswego Communications Center. We're a PSAP that serves Lake Oswego, Westland, and Milwaukee, and I'm also a member of our CAPCOM Venus Legislative Committee.
Could you move that microphone just over a little bit so make sure we get this recorded? Thank you.
Our agency, along with Oregon APCO NENA, supports House Bill 2919, which eliminates the reporting requirement related to disclosure at the request of a law enforcement agency of call information from a cellular device used to call 911 or believed to be in possession of an individual who's believed to be in an emergency situation. My written testimony has been entered into the record, but I'd kind of like to share just an experience of what happens in the PSAP environment when we try and locate somebody and the impact our staff impact it has on our staff when dealing with both the request and then also the follow-up with the reporting language. A practical example starts something like this. The PSAP verifies a circumstance exists that meets the requirements for the request. So basically, one or more people are in serious danger of physical injury or harm. The PSAP staff will then place a call to a wireless carrier, and that's after they've figured out which wireless carrier it is that they need to call. They explain the circumstance. They explain the need. And then depending on which carrier they're dealing with, there several things could happen, one of which they could request a fax request be made first before they take any action. Others will ask you your PSAP information, and then they place a call back to you to verify the request. Others will stay on the line with you and actually provide the information while the operator is on the line, the PSAP operator is on the line with them, but then ask for a follow-up fax which details out the request. Oftentimes this exchange takes several phone calls back and forth between the PSAP and the wireless carrier, and also takes the production of documentation. Sometimes they're faxing us a request form, we're faxing it back, and sometimes we have a generic fax form that we'll send them. All this occurs on recorded phone lines in the PSAP with extensive documentation. At Lake Oswego, for example, we document all that in our computer-aided dispatch histories. We also have the recording of it, and then we also save the request that's been faxed. And we keep all that information according to current records retention schedules. Now, with the current law, we additionally are required to report to the State Office of Emergency Management's 911 program by logging into a separate database, one that the dispatch operators rarely use. And this database was created really for the purpose of tracking these requests. They log into that, and it takes them offline another 3 or 5 minutes to complete the information be processed there. In the case of the Lake Oswego Communications Center, and I think this is pretty generic across the state, the majority of our wireless requests are handled by our carriers in less than 8 minutes. The only occasionally will we see a request that falls outside of that, and that normally is because a phone was powered off, the phone has been switching between networks, and so they're having a hard time on the technical side tracking it, or some other unusual circumstance. So I would like to urge your support of House Bill 2919 to eliminate that reporting requirement that's taking our PSAP staff away from their other duties and their other calls to make that additional reporting requirement. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
Thank you. Go ahead. Are either the presenters, are they going to be here? The sponsors?
So just so it's clear, this is only dealing with the reporting requirement. All the other information you talked about that is recorded or logged regarding that call is still maintained by the centers.
Yes, yes.
Anything else? Seems pretty straightforward. Thank you very much for coming and testifying.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else who wishes to testify? I will. There are several pieces of testimony also in OLIS that was presented. Just remind people of that. Anybody else on House Bill 2919? Okay. I'll close the public hearing. So next I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3395. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3395 establishes Oregon All Funds Crisis Disaster Resourcing Task Force. It requires the task force to report to the legislature by 15 September, sunsets on 31 December 2016, declares the emergency effective on passage. There may be a fiscal revenue impact, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Evans, you can call this something different if you'd like. If you'd like to refer to it in some other term, just so Representative Huffman would maybe go ahead. Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm still Paul Evans, the Representative House District 20, who evidently now is beating Senator Dempose on the task force ideas.
I think you have a new one, yeah.
Yes, I have a new idea. In all seriousness, what I'm trying to do with this and a bill we talked about earlier in the week, or maybe it was last week, having to do with public safety coordination are two pieces of a larger puzzle. One is the delivery systems, which hopefully we can have a conversation about given just the nature of how our tax structures are changing over time. And the second one, and this one I think Representative Huffman might actually be interested in volunteering for, is a discussion about how we are currently paying for public safety systems. There are a number of different ways in which people have, in quite frankly, creative and innovative, stunningly creative ways, found ways to get money into the system to meet the needs of people in crisis. And when I worked for Governor Kulongoski, one of the things that we used to try to figure out was how can we find a little bit of, sometimes it was the confusion over where the funds went and the limitations on how the funding had been put into law at the time that really got in the way of larger efforts. So the goal of this task force would be to really look at every single current statutory type of fee or fund that's associated with public safety and see if we can't figure out a way to make it simpler, less burdensome, and perhaps have a bigger value for our penny. That's the purpose of the task force. I'd try to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any members have any questions? Do you have any questions?
I'm good, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for
bringing this forward.
Thank you, sir.
Sure. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3395? Close the public hearing. Next, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 85. Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 85 permits local governments to provide financial assistance to property owners for seismic preparedness improvements. It specifies the type of assistance and parameters of financial arrangements, conditions financial agreements on written notice to and consent of any affected mortgages as specified, declares an emergency effective on passage. It was voted out of the Senate committee unanimously and then passed on the Senate floor unanimously. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no subsequent referral.
Okay, I'm first going to call up Elizabeth Edwards and Peter Unlinger. Thank you for being here.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland. I'm here today with Peter Englander with the Portland Development Commission, urging your support for Senate Bill 85. Senate Bill 85 would allow local governments to be able to make loans and work with private lenders in order to facilitate financing for seismic rehabilitation of commercial buildings, industrial buildings, and multifamily residential dwellings. So this committee is well aware of what will happen when the Cascadia subduction zone ruptures and knows that we're not prepared, quite frankly. A lot has been done so far addressing public infrastructure, and Senate Bill 85 is just one small step to start to address the tremendous public health and safety issues that will arise from private buildings when the Cascadia subduction zone or other major quakes hit. The classic example is unreinforced masonry. Think of those beautiful old buildings in your districts, beautiful brick buildings in your districts. These are units that were most likely, I mean, if they're old, they were not intended to withstand this type of shaking. The code simply didn't require it of them at the time. So looking at earthquakes from around the world, we know that they're particularly vulnerable to seismic shaking. The mortar isn't weak enough to hold the bricks in place, and they can peel away from the building. They become tremendously dangerous for passersby, members of the public out in the right-of-way. They also have long-term impacts on economic and social recovery of communities because they tend to fall and damage neighboring property. They will displace businesses and residents, often permanently, and they can also generate debris that will block the right-of-way and disrupt transportation routes, which are especially important to keep clear during major emergencies. And these buildings are often prohibitively expensive to retrofit, which is why this bill is important. One thing that I would highlight is that this tool would be voluntary for local governments. It would be voluntary for private building owners to participate. And if there's a mortgage on the property, then the mortgagee must be provided with written consent before they could enter into any kind of agreement. Anyway, that's sort of a high-level overview, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Englander.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the commission, members of the committee, I'm sorry. I am Peter Englander. I am a manager at the Portland Development Commission. I'm here to support SB 85 and encourage your approval. SB 85 grew out of the City of Portland's evaluation of its unreinforced masonry and seismic retrofit codes. Unreinforced masonry, as Elizabeth said, includes some of our most historically significant buildings, not only in the City of Portland, but elsewhere around the state. They define the character and the culture of our neighborhoods, and they are some of our most seismically vulnerable buildings. Just in the City of Portland, commercial and multifamily building stock includes over 1,200 of these buildings. The city's code, the city's goal is to reduce the public safety risk posed by these buildings and to do so in a way that is sensitive to the financial impact on both public and private owners of property. This bill will provide local jurisdictions with a new tool to help finance the seismic retrofit of privately owned buildings. It is not the solution, but it is. It does expand the toolkit. Like we've seen with energy efficiency improvements, this tool provides unique flexibility to maintain financing and improvement of the buildings through ownership transfer. So it's the kind of financing where it would stay on the property once ownership is transferred. And usually when you transfer a building, you pay off a loan and put a new loan on the building. And this is the kind of financing that could still be in force while that happens. So there's a unique capability to that. I encourage your support and happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Questions members might have? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for those of you who might not I'm reminding you that Elizabeth used to be in Brian's chair for the same committee a few years ago. And thank you for coming forward, both of you. And thank you for City of Portland bringing this to the attention of USPAC and the Resilience Plan, Oregon Resilience Plan. There are several members on that body and the task force for Senate Bill 33, which was the implementation arm to put the Oregon Resilience Plan in place. And this is one of several pieces of the plan, recommendations on the plan to get us ready for the big one. And it just can't hurt anyway, even a smaller one. But I know I've talked to a lot of people, and we have several pieces of testimony on this bill in OLIS that you could look at, and some of those people we've worked with for a couple of years on this, to getting this ready. And I want to thank you for coming forward and doing such a fabulous job. When Elizabeth brought it before our committee, this was introduced in the committee. Is it actually on the Senate side? I know, because we had a joint committee in the interim, and so it was posted as a Senate bill. So this is really making it easy for us, and you did such a fabulous job over there that I'm hoping it'll just run smoothly through this way, too, and get this on the books. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Portland for doing this.
Any other questions? Representative Huffman.
Did you ever think a couple of years ago, sitting up here, that you would ever be there looking back?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, never in my wildest dreams.
So I have a question regarding the unique. So cities currently, there's programs within cities that are loan programs in that to, I know in my community we have, the city has loan programs that helps rebuild housing and things, not specifically this. So why, I'm trying to understand the reason for the state to have to authorize this versus you're not already authorized to provide this type of program.
Go ahead.
Chair Lively, this is something where, in working with our city attorneys, looking at our capabilities, it just wasn't the type of loan that we were able to make. And in fact, this builds off of a similar piece of legislation from a year or two ago that was related to energy efficiency retrofits. And so it mimics a similar financing structure. But I can go back and get the exact legal reasoning behind that.
Oh, no, I assume there is. It's just, I just know cities are involved in other types of loan programs, and I wasn't sure. Often cases, it's coming from the city standpoint. I always thought we didn't want the state telling us what we could or couldn't do, so I was assuming we already had, but I can appreciate, obviously, your attorneys figure there's a reason why we're doing this.
Chair Lively, what I would add is that there's a couple of components to it. This is a tool that will enable us to access resources in a different way that are either public resources but also private resources. Yeah. And I can tell you personally that I've been very involved in seismic upgrades of buildings funded by the Portland Development Commission in the City of Portland. As you, I'm sure you all know, it's extremely expensive. And so any tools that we can put in place to give us a larger toolbox of ways in which we can work with the large expense and the way private property owners can figure out how to work that into their building operations. Any tools that we can give to make that all more flexible is helpful. So there may be ways in which we use this tool that does use public money, but it also gives us the flexibility to use private money. And that's exactly, as Elizabeth said, what we're looking at with the Commercial Property Assessed Program for Commercial Energy.
Yeah. Thank you. And when I first talked to Elizabeth about this, I had another, we have another bill that we're working with that has to do with the fuel tanks. And it may provide us with a template to do a similar program on that that would make it more doable for with a public-private partnership rather than the state taking over or the public taking over, or the private taking over completely. It just, you know, we're all in this together. We're all going to be damaged by it in some way, shape, or form, and this is something we can do. And I always have to say, at the end of the day, all the bills that have come out of, and most of the recommendations of our Oregon Resilience Plan are also jobs bills. So that's kind of get a two-way hit on these.
This is true.
Yeah. Thank you. Any further questions? No. Thanks a lot for taking the time to testify.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Two more on the list, Gwen Baldwin and Nikki.
I don't see Gwen here.
Oh, I thought she was here.
She's on her way.
Oh, okay. She's on her way. But you can go ahead and introduce yourself and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association today. And our executive director, Susan Stewart, couldn't be here, but does extend both a deep gratitude for Vice Chair Boone, your long-term commitment to this project, and has enjoyed working with you on it quite a bit. We at BOMA, as we call it, represent about 43 million square feet of commercial real estate. And the panel before me referencing a larger toolbox and additional tools were those large buildings that need it. We know the risks and we know too well the costs affiliated with having to retrofit and in some cases rebuild. And so when or should the worst happen, we're really grateful that this bill is in place. We have a great working partnership with the City of Portland and looking forward to having one more entry point there.
Any questions for Nikki? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Anybody else who's wishing to offer testimony on Senate Bill 85? Oh, we can wait a couple minutes. Unless Representative Huff is in a hurry.
It's a good testimony.
Okay.
It tells you what. No, seriously, she's saving us another bill.
Elizabeth Edwards, for the record. Just briefly, I know that Gwen Baldwin is on her way, but in case she doesn't get here in time, there is testimony submitted on the record from the colloquially known as the Brickers, but individuals that own brick buildings predominantly in the Portland metro area. So you have that for a point of reference as well.
So we can stand at ease for a minute if people want. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we stand at ease for a few minutes?
Thank you.
Right in the nick of time. Okay, I'll call the public hearing on Senate Bill 85 back to order. Gwen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I really deeply appreciate your indulgence and trying to juggle the various hearings and
meetings
going on. Chair Lively and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here today representing the Masonry Building Owners of Oregon. And we are in strong support of Senate Bill 85. We represent the owners of approximately 125 unreinforced masonry, or URM, buildings, mostly located along the I-5 corridor in Portland, Salem, and Eugene. But these buildings occur across the state of Oregon. As you may know, although brick buildings do really well in fire and windstorm and flood, they are particularly vulnerable in a major earthquake. Most URM owners know this and look to seismically upgrade their buildings. So why aren't they being done? In a word, financing. The typical URM building owner simply does not have sufficient savings or cash flow to undertake an expensive seismic upgrade. So the only option to them is to borrow a substantial portion of that project cost. And borrowing usually requires collateral. The typical URM building owner probably has a first mortgage already, which prohibits the owner from getting even a small second mortgage to finance a seismic retrofit. In addition to collateral, a lender wants to know that there's sufficient cash flow so that when the work is done, the loan can be repaid. Unfortunately, the return on seismic upgrades isn't that great compared to other upgrades that can be done. So, for example, a building owner converts, you know, they've got an older URM and they've got a, you know, laundry room in the basement, and they decide to upgrade that and put washer dryers in the units. Well, that might cost the owner $80,000, but they could ask for a $40 a month increase in rent, and they would have people more than willing to pay it. That's a great amenity. Washer dryer in their unit, you bet. So let's assume it's a 32-unit building. That monthly increase translates into about $15,000 in annual rent and a little more than a 5-year payback on that investment. A lender's likely to look pretty favorably on that, given the resulting increase in cash flow. In contrast, an $800,000 seismic upgrade of that same building might only allow a $25 monthly increase, translating into an annual building rent increase of about just under $10,000. So even in the most optimistic scenario, you have that $10,000, you get another $10,000 maybe in reduced insurance costs. You get maybe another $10,000 if you can refinance your first mortgage to get a better percentage. So the total cash flow at best is maybe just under $30,000 annually. That's about a 27-year payback. Not very attractive to a lender. The lack of financing has stalled seismic upgrades, but that in turn rolls the dice on the timing of a major earthquake. And if pressed to do a retrofit, the only other alternative available to an owner is razing that building and redeveloping the site, which deprives communities of a culturally important structure, potentially more affordable housing and less expensive retail and office space. That's why the Masonry Building Owners of Oregon strongly support Senate Bill 85. It allows local governments to create more financial feasibility for seismic upgrades. It doesn't dictate what or when that work might take place. It's not a one, you know, size fits all. It allows them to look for how they can bridge, either by doing and facilitating their own financing or by helping to facilitate private financing. Participation would be voluntary for everyone, owners, lenders, and jurisdictions. We understand there's no one silver bullet. There's no one magic answer to seismic resiliency or how to make seismic upgrades feasible. But we know that this is one way, an important way, and I urge your support for Senate Bill 85. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for what you're doing, and I like this bill and going to be supporting the bill. But I have a question kind of beyond this and conceptually based on the folks that you represent in this case.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a difference in terms of seismic and resiliency upgrade for building life space versus building the structure to where it will resemble itself and be functional afterwards.
Yes.
And if there was something like, in similar fashion to a wetlands bank, where there were funds available, would it be, do you think, or could you take back to your group, not again for this bill, but in terms of larger concept, I assume that the companies that are interested or owners that are interested in this particular bill would seismically upgrade to where it's safe and for life safety as opposed to necessarily being for long-term value of the building in terms of the larger cost. They may not, but there's no requirement for that. If there were funds available, but a commitment to do that, do you think that that was, is something that the masonry folks might be interested in advantage, if there was a state pool that they could leverage out of?
I mean, I think this conversation's happening in a variety of ways. So the short answer is yes. I think the more tools that are available, the more circumstances that can be covered. I mean, there's another bill moving through this session that addresses historic tax credits, and Oregon is one of the few states that doesn't have a tax credit that mimics the federal one. Well, that is an important tool. I think that what you're describing would also be a valuable tool. I think that, you know, coming to terms with what the right level of, is it bolts plus, is it you know, complete, not a blink in how the building could function. I mean, you're right, those are hugely different in terms of what's required, as well as what's the soil and liquefaction. You can put a lot of money into a building, but if the soil it's on isn't going to stand, then have you thrown good money after bad? Probably. And so how do you juggle all those pieces? I don't know, but I'm more tools are better than only one. I can definitely tell you that.
Thank you.
Other questions? So I'm just curious about this organization. So how long is this organization something that has in recent time happened? They've come together in relationship to these types of issues, or is it an organization that's been around much longer time than that?
No, it's been in the last year and a half.
Wondered.
And
okay.
And part of it is the conversations of how do we get this started? And that's happening at some local levels, and that really prompted the group to say, we have to come together and talk about this, because if the assumption is that this is just somehow folks not caring, we wanted to debuse people of that misunderstanding.
Sure.
People care a lot. I mean, not only is it their investment, but there are people who are either living or working in these buildings. But if you have no way to get through the financial barriers, so you're between a rock and a hard place, and ultimately, the only option is you sell it to somebody who's going to raise the building, and that doesn't seem like a very good option either.
There's only a lot of attachment in many communities to other people to these brick buildings.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gwen, thank you again for being part of this effort. This is great. And I can think of, just in my travels around our state, there are always, buildings that stand out, and they may or may not be these buildings, but or historical buildings. But I always think when I travel overseas, the same thing is that they're public buildings that are often historical and the ones that didn't get bombed in the war, things like that. And all over the world, people are doing these things to save these treasures, because art's not always just on the wall. And I think of it, just a very small example in Astoria, they've restored the Liberty Theater. And there's a very strong group of people who support this. They've raised a ton of money and renovated it, and it has murals. I mean, it's whether you go there for an event, which is, they're always good, but if you go and just look at that building, it's incredible. And there are ghosts in it, and they're friendly ghosts. So it's really important to save these things. And I think that, and we, like somebody before you said, too, we don't know if it's going to be in our lifetime or not, but hopefully not. But if it is, at least we'll have done something to get and maybe can save some of these.
Absolutely. Chair Levy, Vice Chair Boone, I really commend you for your passion in trying to make progress on this resiliency, and all the committee members. This is important. It's hard work. And as long as we recognize that it's going to take all hands and many, many tools to do it, I think we're in good hands. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Thanks.
Thank you, Gwen, for taking the time. Anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 85? Not, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 85. Anything else to come before the committee? Doesn't look like it. We'll adjourn.